main thing is not to panic. It's just to stand there and think, okay, what do I do here? What needs to be done to achieve what I want to do?
So in this situation, it's not just the visible tumour that's a concern, but it's the damage and the involvement with the underlying and surrounding tissues that the tumour's invaded. Hello and welcome to the Maswell Moments podcast, and thank you for joining us today. I'm your host and moderator, Ben Whitworth, and I'm very pleased to welcome back to this episode of the podcast, Clive Draper, sales consultant of the Maswell Group. Clive is an accomplished embalmer with over 25 years of experience. Now, today we're going to be discussing facial restoration of cancer damage and how we can overcome this for a positive viewing experience. Clive. Hello.
Hello, Ben.
It's great to have you back with us here today, and thank you very much for giving up some of your time to join us.
Thank you.
Getting straight to it, cancer of the facial tissues can lead to significant distortion of the facial features and in some cases would deter a family from viewing a loved one after death. Can this challenging condition be overcome to allow for restoration of a pre-illness appearance? And should embalmers be prepared to attempt this type of work?
Although it's case dependent, obviously, generally speaking, it can be overcome. And embalmers, given the time, should not think above their capabilities, you know, to take on challenges such as these.
But of course, with a cancerous growth or tumour, it's what's happening with the underlying structures, and that can sometimes affect the vascular system and the selection of arteries and veins for injection and drainage throughout the embalming process. But that's a lot different to there having been some major type of physical trauma.
Yes, right, because normally if there's been somebody's died of trauma, it's normally, well, it's always a unexpected death, so it would be referred to the coroner. There'd be a post-mortem examination, whereas it's pretty unlikely if somebody's died in a hospice of some sort of cancer that needs excising that there's been a post-mortem examination.
And of course, there are going to be some skills that overlap with the different types of trauma and restorative process, and other skills that are suited to one aspect or other, but not necessarily both.
Absolutely.
So this type of work, of course, is going to require a lot more time than a more standard type of case.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and you've got to be willing to put that time aside to do the work.
And of course, in previous episodes of the podcast, we have discussed communication between the funeral director or arranger, the embalmer, and also the family. And that's going to be a very important starting point should this type of work be required.
That's right, because it could be that the family don't want that sort of invasive sort of work doing. They might decide that actually, by all means, go ahead, but they're quite, you know, willing to see the person in that condition. Or they may say, please do what you can to make him better.
So, of course, informed consent is something to be very mindful of.
Absolutely, yeah.
Now, when we're considering this type of work, embalming of the body first, in ensuring that the tissues are firm and dry and in a suitable condition for restorative treatment, has to be a primary concern. What advice would you give to embalmers in terms of techniques that they might use and suitable arterial solutions?
Well, generally in these cases, obviously we need to use quite a strong solution or something that, like maybe Metacin, which is a high firming solution.
We might be thinking about a waterless embalming.
Possibly.
Or instant tissue fixation for the affected area.
Yeah, that sort of thing. Yeah, that's right. And again, harking back to the high pressure and low flow and making sure that everything is saturated as best as we can manage that. Now, that may not be the case that it'll all take place in one day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it could be that you embalm one day, then come back the next day to do the restorative work.
And of course, as we've said already, that's where time cannot be a factor in trying to get this work completed.
No, you've got to take your time, because particularly when you're working on the face, because it is obviously the focus of the family's attention.
Mm-hmm. Of course. Now, for this podcast, we're going to work slightly differently, and we're going to focus on a case study that you had the opportunity to partake in to sort of highlight the point that we're making and outline some more specific information. Could you give the listeners a summary of the case and the extent of the damage that the cancer growth had caused with the facial tissues?
Yeah, sure. I mean, this gentleman, he had had cancer on the right side of his face. A lot of it was subcutaneous.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it was really from sort of the right eye orbit over the zygomatic arch down to the mandible, and actually then almost down to the clavicle on that side.
So it was quite extensive in terms of the regions that it had invaded.
Right, yeah. And it caused a lot of distortion to that side of the face.
So in this situation, it's not just the visible tumour that's a concern, but it's the damage and the involvement with the underlying and surrounding tissues that the tumour's invaded.
That's right, yeah. Because it was causing swelling, that had to be removed as well to maintain some sort of symmetry to the features.
Okay, so we've talked initially about possible pre-embalming and embalming techniques, and we've used maybe a waterless injection with a restricted cervical injection technique, and everything's gone swimmingly. So in cases like this, the embalmer then needs to map out where they think the tumour is running and where they plan to excise cancerous tissue ready for the reconstruction. How is all this best achieved?
Okay, so what I did first, I cut out the damaged tissue right down to the bone, because luckily the bone was not actually involved in the cancer in this case, so it was quite easy to remove from there without giving myself too much of a problem. Yeah, I then cut out the tumour from under the skin on the right hand side of the face up to the lower orbit of the eye.
Okay.
There. Yep.
So Clive, once the initial removal of the tumour has been completed, what does the embalmer need to do in terms of considering any stretching of the skin that may have occurred and any adjustments that may need to be made to the shape of the face?
In this case, the lower lip had to be detached from the mandible to enable a natural look to be reenacted. The edges of the skin were then undercut to enable the edges to be drawn under, if that makes sense, for good transition.
So that undercutting helps when it comes to applying restorative materials and waxing not getting a more visible line of demarcation.
Exactly, yeah. But there was an excess skin from the stretching effect of the tumour, so I had to trim that. And the incision was extended up to the superior border of the zygomatic arch, and round about a centimetre, quarter of an inch, I had to trim off. Then the edges of that were then undercut again, and I sealed it with an intradermal stitch and glue.
And just to jump in there, the tissue that you've removed, the tumorous growth and any trimming of excess skin, how would you treat that and what would you do with that for the listeners' information?
I put that into a small viscera-type bag.
So something like a Ziploc bag?
Yeah. Treat it with a bit of a cavity as normal and leave it with the deceased.
Okay. And if anybody has any concerns about a family maybe looking through the internal components of the casket or coffin, you might take that out for a visitation and then replace it before the coffin or casket was sealed.
Was concerned about it being discovered, yes.
Excellent. And with all of the damaged tissue that's been excised as you're getting ready for the rest of the reconstruction or the restoration process, how do you treat the affected area before you start applying restorative materials?
I would actually treat it with a drying pack.
Okay.
First of all, covering the surrounding skin that was intact with massage cream.
So just to pick up on that point, if you're using Dryene or Dryene 2 around the face, you can protect the tissues from any bleaching or marking by applying a good amount of Calon massage cream.
Yeah, so if you get any dribbling, what have you. Or, of course, the other thing you can do is use Dryene gel these days.
Of course, yes.
Jellies. At this time, I didn't have that available. So
No. But, I mean, for those who haven't used it, the Dryene gel is of a thicker consistency, but it also doesn't contain phenol, so it's more comfortable to work with, but it tends to stay in place a little bit more.
Yeah, it's based on drying too, isn't it? So yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Clive, at this point we've removed the affected cancerous tissues, adjusted the stretched skin and cleaned and cauterized the wound ready for reconstruction. What would come next?
Well, the skin had to be pulled together to present a natural appearance. I did this by stitching a web of suture across the incision, backwards and forwards, and pulling it together slowly to achieve a natural position. Yeah. Then I used inner seal to fill the area, and I used that because it was easy to manipulate into a natural position.
Okay.
I mean, if I didn't have that, I suppose I would have used cotton wool and pore closer and used that as a base. So I would have stuffed it with cotton wool, bit of pore closer over the top, waiting for that to dry, before moving on. I mean, if you are pushed for time, although it's good not to rush, a hairdryer on the cold setting is a good idea to try and do that with.
Wonderful, thank you. So for finishing the reconstruction, what's the best type of wax to use, and is there now a better replacement for wax products when undertaking this type of work?
Well, this wasn't a particularly deep wound after I'd finished with the inner seal. But if there is a deep wound, wound filler is good to start with, and then finish off with surface restorer wax. However, these days there is an excellent alternative to that, and it's called Easy Way Wax. Mm-hmm. Although it's not really a wax, it's a two-part system of liquid and powder. You mix together into a sort of icing sugar sort of consistency that can then be laid onto the area required, smoothed out with a spatula, and then as it starts to cure, you then feather the edges with dry wash on a very soft brush. And that is excellent because it's very easy to contour, and unlike wax, when it has cured, it's very pliable and it won't actually fall out because it sticks to the tissue fantastically well.
So there's not that risk of it being dislodged were a family member to touch it, or
that's right, or if somebody's dressing, what have you, the person, it's not going to get dislodged.
And with that feathering, as far as the dry wash is concerned, less is more.
Yes, yeah, you don't want to, particularly if it's on the Easy Way, mm-hmm. because it's going to take a lot longer to cure,
right?
And if you're using it on wax, you're going to almost dissolve the wax, so you don't want to use too much, just a little bit around the edges to help feather it in there.
Excellent. And when you're happy with the final result and you've finished making adjustments to the Easy Way or the waxes, as the case may be, what would you recommend in terms of final cosmetic application as the deceased is prepared for presentation?
Well, in that case, I used aquachromes with a sponge.
Yeah.
Okay, so dab that on and what have you. And that gave a good effect, actually, to be honest. And then a little bit of powder blown on afterwards. And always good. These days, I'll probably resort to an airbrush.
And, of course, the advantage of the airbrush is that you can apply cosmetics, but you're
without
not risking touching or dislodging
exactly,
the restorative materials.
Airbrushing is an excellent way of applying cosmetic, although it does take a degree of skill to do that. So it's quite a bit of practice involved before you can use it with confidence.
But as with most things that we've discussed, whether it's cosmetics or waxes or airbrushing, practice does tend to make progress, doesn't it?
Exactly. We're not born with the skill, are we? Or any of this knowledge. It's all got to be learnt and practiced. So have a go. There's only things to be gained, isn't there?
And of course, with cosmetics, if you're not happy with that result, you can always remove them or tone them down and start again or adjust them.
With a bit of dry wash. The magic dry wash does everything.
It's another one of those multi-purpose products, isn't it? And you were talking earlier about Inner Seal, and I just have to say, it was one of those products I never used to use. But since I've started using it, I just keep finding more and more uses and find that it's more and more helpful. And of course, dry wash is very much the same. I wouldn't ever be caught without it in the embalming
room.
Exactly.
And the Inner Seal, of course, where you've got the applicator, the gun.
Yes.
I think that helps an awful lot in different sort of situations, rather than just trying to put it on with your spatula, what have you,
the handle of an aneurysm hook, I think, has always been one of the go-tos for many of us, hasn't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
And it's really interesting because there is a whole host of products out there that maybe aren't appreciated until an embalmer is actually able to get their hands on them and see what a difference they can make to that final result.
That's right. The main thing is not to panic, it's just to stand there and think, okay, what do I do here? What needs to be done to achieve what I want to do? So these days, I probably wouldn't use the ligature to go backwards and forwards. I would probably just go to a pack, if you like, and the Inner Seal. I just use that. But you just have to look and think, okay, this is a bit of a puzzle. How am I going to get around it?
And I'm glad you've made that point, because the temptation, whether it's something like a cancerous growth that's deforming the facial features, or if it's a more traumatic reconstruction, the danger is to look at it as a whole and think, I'm never going to be able to tackle that. But if you go one step at a time and you do a little bit and that works, so you do a little bit more, it might take longer and it's a more gradual process. But I'm reminded of another great analogy from a colleague, a mentor of mine. How do you eat an elephant? And the answer, of course, is one bite at a time. Mm. And it's the same with this sort of work. It's one step and then the next step and then the next
Absolutely.
Step.
Absolutely. Don't panic. And of course, you can always turn to colleagues or us, if you like.
Well, we've said throughout this series of podcasts that we are there to help, and at the end of the day, pick up the phone And if we can't get there and physically help you, we'll certainly do what we can to talk you through any processes or procedures that might be useful.
That's right. Don't rush and have a meltdown. That's the main thing.
Clive, thank you. This has been a really fascinating case study to examine with you today. And it reminds me, within my own experiences, the importance and the impact that this can have with bereaved families when they've seen a loved one develop through the course of an illness and in some cases change beyond recognition. And I'm reminded of a couple of cases, one more recently and one many years ago. The first one was of a young 18-year-old lad who had multiple cancerous growths and had sadly had lower limbs amputated because of cancer, but he had a very big growth around his neck, and his mother was desperate to see him, but she didn't want to see him with that growth. And so with her permission, we were able to excise a lot of the tumour, tidy up the excess tissue in a similar manner to what you've mentioned earlier, and then restore everything to a more natural appearance and a few sutures and a little bit of waxing, and that was good to go. More recently, there's a young gentleman who had cancerous growths around the forehead and temporal region. And again, slightly different when a tumour is more noticeable on the side of the face, because at least when the growths are involved, sort of the forehead and the temporal region, you can make incisions in the hairline, which makes them easier to camouflage and hide as the process progresses. But the really big takeaway is to what a comfort and what a value it can be when families come in to see a loved one for the last time. And as we've said in earlier editions of the podcast, to have that final image of peace and rest that maybe the deceased wasn't afforded in the final days and weeks of a protracted or terminal illness. Restoration in all its forms is a fascinating subject, and we hope that the information that we've shared today is helpful to those who are looking to improve their restorative skills and the quality of their embalming work. As with all of the subjects that we've covered, there's always much more to discuss, and of course we can be contacted directly for anybody that wants to have a more in-depth or a one-on-one discussion, not just about facial restoration but about any of the topics that we've covered so far. So please contact us directly as representatives, or contact the Maswell office and one of us will come back to you. We've come to the conclusion of another Maswell moment, and also the conclusion of this first series of podcasts. So on behalf of the Maswell group, the guests and myself, I would like to thank you all for joining us and taking the time to listen to our discussions. We will, of course, be starting to plan our topics and guests for Series 2, and I ask all of you to let me know if there are any topics that you would like us to discuss, or if you have a story that you would like to share with our listeners. We're planning some exciting new guests, and for more information and updates on our podcast series, don't forget to visit our website, themaswellgroup.com. To get in touch for any further information or to share any stories, you can contact us by email on maswellmoments@themaswellgroup.com. Thank you very much for listening, and until next time, take care. This has been the Maswell Moments podcast, helping you so that you can help others.